It's been interesting to see how working on one thing and just getting started opens my eyes up to a new set of problems. You know, when I started Kettle and Fire, I did it because I wanted to make $5 million before I turned 30. And that was it. And I would have done anything. I would have, like, you know, started OnlyFans or something at the time. And as I got more into the food system and everything, I just became more and more aware of all of the problems that are everywhere in the food system.
When I was doing prep for this, I was like, Justin Mayers is probably like the most interesting person that I've studied of the 400. So no pressure to live up to that expectation. But I was like, are you kidding me? There are so many different rabbit holes that we could go down for this conversation.
Yeah.
And so because of that, I was so excited and so like, and then I talked to Nat Eliason and David Perel about you, and then they just gave me 50 more topics to talk about. So I figured a good place to start would be with Mac Miller's Tiny Desk Concert.
Okay.
Why are you top 1% in the world at consuming Mac Miller's Tiny Desk Concert?
I love that question. So I think you, have you watched it?
Yeah.
Dude, it is just incredible. Like, I think that Mac Miller is one of, I really appreciated seeing an artist that is famous for a very popular type of music, and seeing him in his element, working in bass and a bunch of other artists that he hadn't played with before and stuff like that. I think it's an amazing piece of content that just really speaks to me for reasons I don't fully understand.
I love that when you tweeted that, you said, what are you a top 1% consumer of?
Yeah.
Because that speaks about who you are as a person. And I know you're also probably a top 1% consumer of David Senra's Founders Podcast.
At this point, for sure.
Have you listened to every single one?
Not everyone yet. Like, I basically discovered it in June, right? Mm. And so I'm 3 months into listening to it. Yeah. And I was traveling this summer, and I basically was devouring like 1 to 2 episodes a day. It was ridiculous.
Wow.
And he is so good at making that podcast. It is so fucking good.
Yeah.
Like, I love it.
What do our consumption patterns say about ourselves?
I think that at various times in your life, you kind of feel drawn to different things. Like, there was a time where I was working a lot, and that's when I was drawn to like the Mac Miller thing. I was like on my computer all the time, you know, everything like that. And it was inspiring in a certain way. Now I'm in a phase of life where this summer I was somewhere beautiful. I would go for long walks by the lake, thinking about just listening to Founders podcasts and thinking about, you know, how do we make the stuff that I'm involved in as great as it can possibly be. But I'm in a very different headspace now than I was, you know, 7 years ago or 6 years ago, when I was just like pounding the Mac Miller tiny desk thing, looking for like creative inspiration, you know?
So what would you say your current obsession is?
Good question. I mean, the intellectual thread that I am obsessed with right now is, I think the most important question in the US is, why is everyone sick and unhealthy? And getting worse. Like, the current generation of kids is the least healthy generation that has basically ever existed in the US. And why is it that everyone that we know is struggling with their weight, with, you know, chronic conditions, with inflammation, with autoimmune issues, all these sorts of things? And almost no one is talking about it. We're told that it is a medical problem, not a problem with our food system or environment. And it just seems like, truly to me, the biggest question in the US, in the world, is why, as countries to get richer, do they get sicker? And no one, in my opinion, is asking or trying to understand the root cause of that, which I like fundamentally don't understand and I'm just obsessed with.
I was going to ask you why. Why does no one care about it?
I think that people care. I think that the reality is that there are a lot of interests right now that profit off of like the sick American consumer. And so I think that when I see something like, there was a study is an incredibly loose word, that came out last year that called the Tufts nutrition compass, basically. And the results of this study, which was, you know, millions of dollars from the National Institute of Health, funding a 3-year-long initiative to like categorize, you know, 9,000 different types of foods and say what is most nutritious. The result of this study is that Cheerios, Lucky Charms, and like 30 other brand name cereals are more nutritious than beef.
What?
Like crazy shit. And so when I look at stuff like that, you also dig a little bit and you go, okay, the dean of nutrition was funded by Danone. You know, Danone has the number one almond milk in the country, and it turns out, like, in the world actually, and it turns out, like, almond milk is one of the most nutritious foods that you could possibly have. You know, there's all these things, and you just go, okay, basically there are these interests, and I think ag companies and big food companies are at the forefront of it, that make a ton of money off of selling horrible, horrible products that make the average American sicker. And then on the flip side, you know, you see that there are healthcare, you know, health companies, pharmaceutical companies, the every player in basically the healthcare industry that gets paid and does very well when the average consumer is sicker. And so I think that you have this horrible structural issue in the US where everyone makes more money when the average consumer or the average American is sick but not dead. And so that's kind of what I think you have in the US. Like, if you follow the incentives, implicit, explicit, I'm not saying that like many of these people are evil or anything like that, but there is this implicit incentive to not actually look out for the American consumer and their health, because literally everyone in the healthcare, food, ag value chain makes more money when the average American is sick.
Wow. Was it always that way?
No. No, I mean, change. You know, look 50 years ago and basically the, you know, rates of chronic disease were down, you know, they're like up 400% in the last 50 years. I think what changed is a couple things. I think basically subsidies, crop subsidies were introduced shortly after World War II, which incentivizes a certain type of agriculture, basically one that was industrialized agriculture that relied heavily on chemical fertilizers and that massively promoted the planting and growing of corn, soy, wheat, as opposed to diversified, you know, ways of farming and doing agriculture. So that's one. So you see incentives for corn, soy, wheat, and then all of a sudden, 50 years later, corn, soy, and wheat are in everything. Soybean oil is like makes up almost 20% of the average American's daily calories. High fructose corn syrup is in everything. Why are they using corn syrup rather than sugar? Well, because it's basically free, because it's been subsidized like crazy. And so it makes its way into fucking everything. And then wheat, like 50 years ago, gluten allergies, it was just like not a thing. What is gluten-free? You see like all these news articles, which are hilarious to read, in the early 2000s that are talking about like, how is everyone gluten-free and having gluten, you know? It just wasn't a thing, like just a couple decades ago. And now wheat is in everything in its most processed form, loaded with a bunch of pesticides and herbicides and other things. And guess what? A bunch of people have gluten allergies, autoimmune conditions, and the like. And so I think that ag subsidies plus largely like big food companies having effectively, they're run by shareholders. And in the 80s, 90s, there was a big shareholder push to strip costs out of these big food companies and just make them crazy profit centers. That meant that you replaced sugar with high fructose corn syrup. It meant that you know, threw that chemical in X product that didn't used to have it, and you know, now it does. And I think that all of these little things created a society and a world where, as an average American, if you are not extremely inordinately conscious about your health, you are going to be sick.
And you didn't even mention the water.
Yeah. Yeah, it's another topic I've been going down into lately. So I appreciate the Mountain Valley spring water here.
We got to get them to sponsor the show.
Totally.
But I mean, when I listen to you talk on Patrick O'Shaughnessy's podcast, which is linked down below, incredible episode you had with him, I was like, I was overwhelmed, and I feel kind of overwhelmed now. Like, yeah. Oh no, what can I do? And am I like, I feel so helpless in the face of all the forces that are going against me. I work out, I meditate, I do all the things you're supposed to do, it feels like, and I can't drink the water at the gym that I go to. Like, even that's poison. So, you know, what does that mean? And what does the average person do if they feel overwhelmed by all of this?
Yeah, it's exceptionally hard. I would say that right now we are at a point where I think if you talk to your grandma or something like that about eating healthy, like your grandma never even really thought about this. This is just like not a thing, that she was not like into diet culture. She was not into like all these different things. You know, you look like a healthy, fit dude. You probably watch what you eat. I'm guessing you're some flavor of paleo or low carb or whatever. we, like, people like us just didn't exist because we didn't have to 50 years ago.
Wow.
And so I basically think that our food and lifestyle environment is so dysfunctional and so messed up that what you, as far as what you can do, I think that the average person, unfortunately, if you want to be healthy, you have to go through this like crazy period of spinning up a bunch of knowledge around what is good for you and what is bad. Often today, fortunately, that looks like people following influencers like Peter Attia, Huberman, and the like, as opposed to listening to doctors that pretend nutrition is like not a thing. Yeah, it's crazy. We can go down that rabbit hole if you want. But I basically think that you have to pick one or many nutritional philosophies. I think that the high level goals that I think are eat what your ancestors ate in the highest quality that you can afford, and try and, you know, do that within some bounds of moderation, and you're probably 80% of the way there. There's certain things like, yeah, water is something that I'm very concerned about. Like water quality in general is like really heinous. That said, for most people, it probably won't kill you to be exposed to these things like drinking at the gym and stuff like that. I think, though, that if you're talking about your home environment or your office environment where you're consuming a lot of food and water and stuff like that, you know, having really strong filtration, having things like this are kind of the 80-20, I think.
And for everyone listening right now who's like, what is this guy talking about? What type of credibility does he have? It's like you started a bone broth company when it was not a popular thing to do at all. You invested in Bitcoin way before you have a history of spotting trends and seeing where the world is going.
Yeah.
When did you first notice that skill in yourself?
You know, it's funny. I would not say that I necessarily noticed it as a skill that I had until after the fact. Hmm. Like when I invested in Bitcoin, and a couple other things that were like pretty early when other, not a lot of people were talking
when,
about
when
it.
When did you invest in Bitcoin around?
Like 2011.
Wow. Then?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so I bought in then. Unfortunately, I didn't have that much money at the time. You know, I was literally in college, but whatever. But I bought in then, and at the time, it doesn't feel like, wow, I'm spotting a trend and I'm like totally ahead of everyone. It feels like, well, this seems interesting and I'm stupid, so I'm okay with losing some money, you know, is much more what it feels like. And that's kind of how I've felt across a lot of different domains. Like with very, very few exceptions, actually psychedelics were one of the few exceptions to this. And a lot of the health stuff that I believe now is sort of the exception to that. But with very few exceptions, when I've been ahead on a trend, it has not been like I have crazy conviction and I go all in like some of the other Bitcoin people in 2011, which more power to them. They're way richer than I am now. You know, I basically think of it like, this is interesting. I'm going to size a bet appropriately because I think it's compelling enough to make a bet, and then kind of move on with my life. And yeah, all that to say, you asked like why I thought this was, when I realized this is a thing I had, it took me a long, you know, it took me years, 8-9 years to see like, okay, I hit on a couple things. I was like ahead on bone broth, like a lot of the crypto stuff I was ahead on, you know, a couple other things. And after that, after seeing that for 7 or 8 years, I was like, okay, maybe this is actually a skill that I have, but I wasn't sure. And only in the last like 2 years, have I felt slightly more confident that this is something I'm good at.
Yeah. That's how I feel about my friend, Nat Eliason, who I mentioned before, and your friend as well. I feel like I am doing often the things that he was doing 6 months ago,
yeah,
or a year ago. And I'm like, how does he always know? So, and I feel like I'd put you in the same bucket of people. How do you know? Like, what are you looking for? What should I be looking for? What should someone be looking for to be ahead of where the world is going?
Yeah, I think that I'm not looking to be the head of where the world is going in any way. I think the thing that drives me is a deep sense of curiosity and a really strong desire to understand, like, take a given problem, what works for this. So, for example, when I came across psychedelics, one of the things that I was very conscious of, I had just gone through a breakup. I, you know, had family members that were struggling with depression. I had a bunch of stuff. And somehow I had someone tell me about psychedelics in some way and how, you know, how they were useful. And I kind of looked into it and I was like, whoa. One, we have almost no good pathways around addressing mental health issues in this country. You know, if you break a leg, you go to the hospital, we put you in a cast, and we go 99.9% chance that leg is going to heal and we can tell you how long it'll take and whatnot. If you come to a therapist with depression, there is nothing like that. And so what you're seeing now is that psychedelics and psychedelic assisted therapy is clinically, and like research is showing, that it is the most effective treatment for a bunch of modalities and issues in mental health, like anxiety, PTSD, depression, and like. And so as I was just kind of studying and curious about this, someone mentioned psychedelics are useful for X. I kind of like dug into the research and you go, whoa, this is a class of substances that were previously banned. They were incredibly effective, incredibly effective. There's a really long cultural history of humans using psychedelic substances to deal with anxiety, depression, you know, to see God, whatever you want to call it. And all of that cultural history, research, everything was just kind of thrown away with Nixon in the drug wars, basically. And that was really interesting to me. And so I was like, okay, this seems like it works. There's an interesting history of it. And sure, there's a question of timing, like maybe psychedelics won't be a thing for another decade, but certainly the stuff works. And so if it works, it's a pretty reasonable bet to make that the thing that works will win out in the long run, in, you know, relative to SSRIs and a bunch of other things that like generally aren't that effective.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I will also say, like, you credit curiosity to that. And I obviously you're a curious person, but it's like, I stumbled across the guy, Matt Johnson. Is that his name? Mike Johnson,
yeah.
Your friend?
Yeah.
It's like, how'd you stumble across him? And like, what is that? What is that all about?
Yeah. So Mike Johnson is, I think, one of the most interesting humans in the world and that I'm aware of. So I came across an article that he wrote on something called the neural annealing, which is sort of this idea that he has around how the brain and how, like, basically how your brain experiences consciousness and how that changes. You know, how do you take someone from a depressed state to someone who is not? There's changes that happen in the brain and the gut and your neurons and all these sorts of things. He has this theory of consciousness that he now calls like the symmetry theory of valence, which we can get into, but it's pretty technical. But I basically came across something that he had written about, this symmetry theory of valence and this idea of neural annealing. I read the post. It was incredibly well thought out. It was really interesting. It touched on a bunch of stuff that I'd read on neuroscience and consciousness and other things that that I find compelling. And I also had a bunch of questions. And so I just emailed him. And he is this amazingly kind, sweet, super genius. And we basically just got dinner in San Francisco one night. And he was like, yeah, you know, I spent hours of working on this piece. And I've spent tens of thousands of hours thinking about this topic. And I get like 5 emails a year from people that are interested in this stuff. And so I feel like that is a thing that when I come across something interesting, I am unapologetic about emailing that person or trying to get in touch with that person and just kind of poke at the idea that they're playing with a little bit.
Yeah, this is a great idea. I always tell people, when you like stuff on social media or when you like stuff on podcasts or whatever, like, send that person a message to let them know.
Yeah.
It's rare how few people actually do that, and it creates an amazing connection.
What Even about, more than that, yeah. though, I think that like asking questions that poke at people's thinking is way more is really useful.
Yes.
Like, I have people that I've met through my newsletter who respond to something that I'm talking about, and they're like, have you considered X or have you considered this? And I've gotten certainly emails from people that say, I love the newsletter and it's really kind and of them to like take the time to write in. But I've actually developed relationships with people that are like pushing my thinking in a direction that I wasn't aware of previously.
And that's the power of putting things out there online, is like,
totally.
The things you get back are incredible. And that's why I take such pride in finding people who are interesting and thoughtful, because I'm like, I'm associating with this person's network. I have David Perel on the podcast. The amount of people – I have you on the podcast. The amount of people who are following you who are smart, I'm like
– Oh, Perel's way bigger. I love that guy.
Yeah, but I want to go back to what was the – could you break down your friend's theory in like a fifth grade level? Because the thing is that is a central question of my life. It's like, how do you take people who are depressed and make them happy, right? Like, to me, that's one of the big questions. You know, the obesity things that you think about and that excite you? That excites me. like to no end. But I'm not smart enough to like grasp the
You're smart enough. It's just a function of time, you know what I mean?
That's true.
So his theory is basically that he has this concept of sort of neural harmonics, if you want to call it that, where you can think of the brain as sort of this tuning engine in a sense, where if different parts of your brain and your brain harmonics, which you can literally think of as like hit a tuning fork that has a certain harmonic frequency, certain like your brain has similar harmonic patterns basically. And so there's a way that you can map one's like connectome and the harmonics in your connectome that his hypothesis is based on the resonant frequencies of one's connectome, either being like harmonic or discordant, are also a really good proxy or basically isomorphic to like one's experience of consciousness. And so his theory, like what he calls the symmetry theory of valence, is that, you know, rather than saying, you know, hey, Danny, are you depressed? Great, let's talk about it. And I'll throw some stuff your way and hopefully it works. You could actually map one's connectome. You could see, okay, there's like discordance here and here and here. Wow. Here is the like ideal harmonic connectome that we want to get you to move you from this discordant sort of neural state to one of harmonics. And that by moving someone, that focusing on that like physical substrate of the brain's connectome, you basically could move someone out of a depressed state and into something that feels, you know, their experience of consciousness feels more alive, high energy, happy, all of that.
That is fascinating because
it's really fascinating.
Our current understanding is like, go to therapy, become aware of the ways in which you were abused as a child, bring awareness to that, and then you'll feel some relief because of that. And it's like, that's great. That's better than it was 50 years ago, but that's not the end state of making people happy and fulfilled and filled.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, have you read David Deutsch at all? He's like a philosopher guy, but he talks about something that has really stuck with me is that like a good theory of knowledge is, testable and falsifiable, and predictive. And so those are the three things. And so if you think about therapy today, you go, hey, you're depressed. If I throw you in a therapist, their certain approach, it is not like predictive into a strong degree of accuracy that you are going to get better through that talk therapy. And so Mike's whole thing is that we need a better understanding of consciousness and an understanding of like what it means to be conscious, how you measure it, and how you can like how your the physical substrate of your brain neurons and connectome are related to your experience of being conscious. Like that theory is the underpinnings that we need to actually do interventions that move you in a direction that like you may want from a depression, anxiety, whatever standpoint.
Yeah.
Which I think is, you know, basically take, I am depressed and here's a treatment, turn that into what David Deutsch would call like a real theory of knowledge and create a intervention set that is like predictive, testable, and falsifiable.
Do you believe the world is getting better or worse?
I think it depends who you ask.
I'm asking you.
Cool. Great question. Great point. I think that it is certainly doing both, which is the cop-out answer.
Yeah.
I think that in many ways, the world has never been better than it is right now. I also think that in many ways, it's never been worse. Yeah. My personal take is I think my world is getting better all the time. Like I'm happier and everything like that right now. Is that true? Does that generalize to everyone in Austin? No. The US? No. You know, I don't know. So that's a really bad answer.
it's the truthful answer of like, my life is getting better, my world is getting better, but generally speaking, people's lives are getting worse.
Yeah.
How do you reconcile that?
I think a lot about something, I believe it was Nassim Taleb said, where he made the point that specific to the US, the US sort of optimizes for tail outcomes, which is really great in some ways and horrible in a lot of ways. So how I think about rectifying that, like the US right now has some of the wealthiest, smartest people that are building technology that like is definitely making humanity, you know, advancing humanity and making humans more interesting as a species, doing a bunch of shit that is just crazy. And like the average X billion dollar or trillion dollar company is based in the US, is a technology company. And we have this whole incredible industry of super smart sociopaths working to like build technology that's amazing for people. It's awesome. You also have, I think, and then, you know, below that we have venture capital, we have amazing schools, we have like this whole sort of infrastructure that enables your average insanely smart person in the US to do quite well relative to your average insanely smart person somewhere else in the world, in Thailand or something. So that's really great, I think. I think it comes at a cost though, where if you think of the average person in the US, the average person has, like the average male in the US at least, has like 0.8 close friends, you know, obesity is almost 45%. The average you know, 72% of the country is overweight. 93% of the country is like metabolically unfit. Our schools system is horrible. Our healthcare system is like, has the worst outcomes per dollar in anywhere in the world. And so I think that you look at the life of an average person in the US and all of the societal infrastructure that we've built to support those people is basically in about as bad of a position as it's ever been. And so I think that as a person that is ambitious and wants to work hard and wants to have a tail outcome, like the US is the best place in the world. I think that for the average person that doesn't want to be poisoned by their food, wants to have access to good healthcare, good outdoors, a not crazy work schedule, you know, these sorts of things that make life meaningful and worth living. You even have friends that fucking live close to them, not live in a city dominated by cars. Like Europe and other countries do that much better than the US does. Mm. So that's something I think about.
No.
I rectify it.
Yeah. I mean, so the answer is to move to Europe, like, or it's to make the most out of your situation.
I think the answer is to decide what you want and then kind of try and optimize around that. You know, I think that if you want a life that is not a crazy, you know, not like a crazy tail outcome, which is amazing, like, I think that living in a major city in the US it's much harder to have that than somewhere in Europe or a mountain town in the US or a small town, you know, like a suburb outside of Austin or something like that. I think though, yeah. And so I think that both the US gives amazing options to people that want the choice and want to do things that are amazing. I also think that for the average person, the US is a really depressing and like challenging place to live right now.
Yeah. What do you think about, what's your current perspective on whether you're going to build multiple companies or focus your attention and energy on one?
Yeah. So I have previously done the multiple company thing. I guess I'm still doing it in that the other companies that I've started are still running and I'm still have like some light levels of involvement. But I think for a bit, I feel for the last couple of years, I've been trying to figure out and find what is like a mission and a potential solution to that mission that I am super fired up about and just want to work on for a very long period of time. And I feel like I've kind of found that for the first time in a while. And so for sort of a indefinite period, I'm trying on the hat of like, let me just work on one thing and try and make it amazing, try and make it like work as best as I can. And if it works, I think it has a better shot of anything else that I've started at like actually improving and changing the food and you know, wellness world that I think is just, as I said, the biggest problem in the US.
Okay, so what is that thing and how do you come to the decision that this is what I want to devote my life to?
Yeah, it wasn't a linear decision for sure. It wasn't an easy decision, but the thing that we're working on now is called TrueMed. Basically, if you talk to almost anyone, it is hard to be healthy. Like not only how do I be healthy? Like as you just asked a little bit ago, but it's expensive. And so, you know, this whole foods, whole paycheck thing is like it's a real joke for a reason because it is very expensive to be healthy. I've seen it running Kettle and Fire. Our product is more expensive than any other like broth or bone broth on the shelves. That's because we pay way more than like a Campbell's or Pacific for the raw materials that we put into our product. Now, I think that that is messed up. Like if you as a consumer are incentivized to buy the cheaper thing every time you make a food decision over a 70-year life, you are slowly going to lose your health as those decisions compound and add up. And so I think that one of the things that the U.S. needs desperately is a way to actually fix the incentives that tip the average American towards making choices that make them less healthy. So what we're doing with TrueMed is we basically found there's a type of account called HSA and FSA. These are like tax-free accounts. Often your employer puts money in them for you that can be spent on health and wellness items, basically, or health items. So what TrueMed is doing is we're building a payments tool that makes it so that you can use your tax-free HSA, FSA dollars to buy a Peloton, pay for a gym membership, pay for supplements, invest in things that keep you healthy and that improve your wellness, as opposed to just paying for prescriptions, pills, surgeries, and the like once you've already like been sick or had an issue. And so that's what I'm working on right now. And I think that our overall goal is we want to massively increase the number of people that are contributing money to their HSA, FSA, and move every dollar that is in HSA and FSA, which is, you know, about $150 billion as of today, towards wellness and away from just paying for shit after people are sick.
Wow. Okay, so I guess how it came about for you was you noticed the problems that were occurring in the first companies that you started running. And you're like, all right, like there's a bigger issue here than just bone broth. Like there's a bigger issue here. Like, and so I guess my question is like, at what point do you realize that what you were working on was actually not about bone broth at all?
I think that often in my life, it's been interesting to see how working on one thing and just getting started opens my eyes up to a new set of problems. You know, when I started Kettle and Fire, I did it because I wanted to make $5 million before I turned 30. And that was it. And I would have done anything. I would have started OnlyFans or something at the time. And as I got more into the food system and everything, I just became more and more aware of all of the problems that are everywhere in the food system. And going down this path and thinking more and more, hearing thousands of customers say, your stuff is so expensive, why is that? Had sort of seeded in me this openness or line of thinking around how can we actually make it cheap or more affordable to be healthy. And then when I came across this idea around, you know, using HSA FSA to invest and buy things that keep someone healthy through my co-founder Callie, things just kind of clicked and it was like, okay, this feels really exciting. Let's do it.
Yeah. The reason why I go down this line of questioning is because part of this podcast is about helping people find purpose in their life. And I was going through your newsletter and you had this really interesting thing where you were talking about how I think finding your passion is one, hard to do for anyone, but damn near impossible for someone under 25. And two, not the real goal. Instead of finding your passion, find your problem. And the reason why this hit me so much is because if you're under 25 and you don't haven't experienced any problems in your life, then of course you can't find a passion. You can't find something that excites you and lights you up because you haven't been through enough challenges to understand what is difficult and what you can actually solve.
Totally.
So,
and I also think that as a 25-year-old, and you know, I did this, the problems that you're aware of are so surface level.
Yes.
That it requires going 3, 4, 5 levels deeper, in my opinion, to come to the type of insight or conviction around a problem that is required to start what I think is like a really interesting company. This isn't always true. Like the DoorDash founders or whatever apparently were like at Stanford and they were like, no one delivers in Palo Alto. Let's start DoorDash. And like that clearly worked for them. But I think for almost everyone, if you're under 25, it would serve you way better to focus on skill acquisition and just trying to make some amount of money that proves that you have the skills to make money, and then keep your eyes peeled to like, what are the problems that just tug at you and that you want to talk about with your friends on the weekends and stuff like this. And for me, that was health. Like I was spending my Saturday mornings reading about health. I was like talking to people in the paleo movement very early. I was going to Paleo FX when no one knew what paleo was and people weren't talking about it. It just pulled at me, you know?
What about someone's listening to this under 25 and they hear like, all right, Justin says, get some skills. I want to get some skills. Where should they be thinking or what should they be thinking about? skill acquisition.
So probably the best thing I have ever read on this topic is this guy, Charlie Hoehn, used to work with Tim Ferriss, and he wrote something called Recession-Proof Graduate is what it's called. And basically the idea is, the whole thing is so worth reading. It has changed my career multiple times. But the whole thing is basically find someone who is doing the thing that you want to do, use free work to demonstrate that you know what you're talking about, and then work with them no matter the cost. And I think that as someone who wants to pick up skills and build a network and like do something interesting in the world, working with people that are doing the thing you want to do is by far the best thing that you can do.
Mm. You mentioned network there, and David Perel said you're the most popular person in Austin, Texas, and you have the most text messages. That's his perception of you. How have you gone about doing that?
I think that it stems, honestly, from I'm really comfortable reaching out to people and having conversations and trying to be helpful and trying to like connect people and stuff. But honestly, I think that I am doing a 4 out of 10 job as a network person. And I think that I want to, in the next 2 years, do a 10 out of 10 job and like be amazing at it.
What does 4 out of 10 look like? And what does 10 out of 10 look like?
4 out of 10 looks like it's not deliberate. I'm not, I don't have like a personal CRM. I'm not hosting things intentionally. I don't have structure around when I catch up with people and all this sort of thing. 10 out of 10 is hosting way more things, having like a weekly or every other week, you know, I'm going to do a happy hour or a barbecue at my house, invite 40 people, having like a friend newsletter that I send to second degree connections, which I used to do and don't anymore. Fortunately, the newsletter has helped a lot in that area. And then being very intentional about outreaching to people that I think are talented or interesting. Like there's a guy in town, Joe Lonsdale, who he apparently around graduation time or shortly before has his assistant line up conversations with like 45 or 90 of the most entrepreneurial college graduates in the country.
Oh my God.
He then schedules calls with each of them in 3-minute increments, has like his assistants handing him like 2 or 3 phones, and basically is just like, hey, Danny, I'm Joe. How can I help you? And just like has his team go to work for some of the most talented soon-to-be graduates in the U.S. And he has funded these people. He started companies with these people. He's done a bunch of shit. And like that is insane. Like it's so amazing. That's what a 10 looks like to me. And I want to like get to that point at some point.
The more that I do this podcast, the more that I realize how people are at the heart of everything. And it sounds so obvious, but the more that I've seen how people operate, it's like the people who have the most connections and the people who have the deepest connections with those people are the people who are the furthest ahead, it feels like. Someone listening to this is in college or is in, you know, their first few years of working. What can they do to help themselves? Obviously, you gave a bunch of great suggestions there from going from a 4 out of 10 to a 10 out of 10, but specific to that person who is in college or is about to graduate.
Yeah. So I feel like I did a lot of work here, honestly. I grew up in the DC area, relatively introverted, went to school at University of Pittsburgh. Like I'm not like a Stanford, Silicon Valley, you know, my dad's a CPA, not like a super well-connected family or anything. And so I think 2 things. One, the free work thing that I talked about is unbelievable. I did free work I moved to San Francisco shortly after graduating to be in like the startup scene. And I did free work for 5 or 6 people where I would just email them. I'd be like, hey, your site sucks. Here's what I would do. Here's like the emails I would send. Smart. Just put like hours of time into just sending this thing. And that allowed me to meet so many people that were doing amazing things in the world that I didn't have any business meeting as like a 22-year-old, you know, grad with no skills. The second thing I think is really useful and what I did is when I was in Pittsburgh, I realized that I was bad at meeting people and I was bad at like one-on-one conversation. And so for a year, I literally made a challenge and emailed a bunch of people in the Pittsburgh startup scene and entrepreneurial scene and took 3 to 5 people out to coffee a week for an entire year. So 1, great for network. 2, great for building social skills. I mean, my first one, I remember just sitting there and being like, What do I say? It was like so bad. Like I was just, it was so bad.
Why were you so bad? Was it because you were homeschooled or is that unrelated?
I think that was related. Yeah, for sure. I just think I was an awkward dude, you know? I was like introverted and homeschooled and didn't have a lot of like social reps growing up.
So odd for me to imagine today and exciting, like that you're just like the most personable guy that was your start point.
Yeah, I got married earlier this year and my mom at my wedding speech said like, it's amazing to see you as like this little introverted shy boy now, like having all these friends and stuff like that, which is just hilarious, you know? So I did that. And I, again, when I got to San Francisco, I was shameless about emailing people that I thought were doing interesting things. So at the time I was working on a 3D printing company. I emailed the COO of Heroku, which was like doing, anyway, it was like a thing that was doing something adjacent in software, what we were trying to do in 3D printing. He was like, yep, I'll grab coffee with you. Come by my office. Went to his office, met this other guy who was playing ping pong there and had a 3D printer. We started talking about that. And then I ended up working with this guy for like 2 years and I learned almost everything I know from that guy. And so just like, if you don't have a network, being unapologetically aggressive about cold emailing people that are doing interesting things in the world and asking them questions and being thoughtful and giving value to them, I think is the best way to build a network by far. It still works for me. I'm like pretty busy at this point and it still works.
Yeah, same. Who are the most interesting people right now you find who are doing things that are going to be where the future is headed?
Good question. I think David Perel is one of these people. I love that dude. And I think that he has an insight on education and where the world is going in that realm that is spot on. I think that there are people that are doing, like Brian Johnson is doing a bunch of stuff with Blueprint that a lot of people think is weird, and it is weird. You know, it's weird how often he compares himself to 18-year-olds. But on the other side, he is doing humans such an incredible service. He's spending $2 million or $3 million a year on his body and his health and publishing all of it. It's like incredible. From a health standpoint, I think that Mark Hyman has been really far ahead on a bunch of trends and interest in like functional and wellness. There's another guy, Sam Knowlton, who I look up to from an agricultural standpoint, Mike Johnson from this like consciousness neuroscience stuff. I'd have to like go through my Twitter list. Honestly.
Yeah. Well, no, what's really cool about this is someone listening to this, maybe they're not associated or they send an email to David Perel and he doesn't respond. Find out the people who David Perel follows.
Totally.
And go through David Perel's likes on Twitter. Go through Brian Johnson's likes. Find their network. If you can't get those people,
totally.
Like, look at the people surrounding them.
Yeah. And honestly, to be honest, the people that those nodes follow are often doing the most cutting edge, interesting stuff. I follow some crazy accounts that I'm not sure if they're right or not. One guy is talking about how I've been interested in the impact of light on health and energy. And his whole thing is what he says now is he's like, I don't believe in any nutrition or health study because they didn't control for light exposure, which is true.
Wow.
And so if he's right, like that, you know, light exposure has crazy impacts on metabolism, mitochondrial function, all these things. It's true. We have never run an RCT or a nutrition intervention where light exposure has been controlled for.
Oh my God.
I could say the same is true of water in many ways. Like we haven't actually run in, like almost nothing in the nutrition research canon has controlled for water quality.
Wow.
Yeah. Or emotional trauma, other people would say. There's all these weird things that I think if someone followed those people, it'd be pretty easy to one realize that like I'm kind of a weird dude, but also get in with some of these people that are like sub 2,000 followers on Twitter just talking about shit that I find fascinating.
Yeah, I think uncovering signal from noise there is like the skill, and obviously the skill that you have because you've put your money and time and energy into things that have actually worked. So what do you know about deciphering the signal from the noise that most people don't?
I think that deciphering that requires having an opinion on how the world works. And one of my, like to use this light guy, for example, a lot of people look at that and they go, that's crazy. Like that's just a stupid idea. And they write it off instantly. Why I think this is interesting is a couple things. He was also early in Bitcoin, kind of like first principles thinker, potentially. I'm like in my evaluating him for signal to noise phase, so this could be totally wrong in 6 months. But early Bitcoin, and what he is talking about and the way that he talks about things fits exactly into my model of health, which is basically that if you think of a human organism living 50,000 years ago, how that person lived was, you know, and that person is like biologically very, very similar to where we are right now. So how that person lived was they were eating fresh organic foods all the time. You know, there was no such thing as chemical exposure. They were getting super clean water. They're eating meat. They're eating vegetables. They're eating like a diverse diet of all these things. They're eating seasonally, and they were getting light exposure all the time. And so if I think my like way of viewing health is every time you remove the human organism from that like platonic 50,000 years ago sort of environment, you create disease where in the areas where like you furthest remove what a human has exposure to today versus what they had 50,000 years ago. Like our food is so different today than it was 50,000 years ago. And that is causing a whole host of health issues. I could say this the exact same thing about light. Like the average person today is getting so much less light than they were 50,000 years ago, which is why when I come across this guy talking about this, it like perfectly fits my mental model of what causes disease and like ill health in the modern world. And so I'm like interested in paying attention.
Wow. Yeah. I love that you broke that down because that's very helpful for someone evaluating something on their own. I'm curious about like breaking down your personality a little bit. David Perel talked about how you're a super calm guy.
Yeah.
And that how it's almost like a fish in water where you don't even realize like that it's part of you. And so I'm curious, like, when you first realized that you were calm in nature.
I think part of it is genetic. Like, yeah, my grandfather is the most chill. Like, my mom grew up, and she said, yeah, I saw my dad get mad at me and raise his voice one time, my entire upbringing. And that was when I crashed our car, you know? And so like, she crashes the car, and he's like, raises his voice a little bit.
Wow.
You know? And so I think there's some of that. I also think that for, you know, true or untrue, I think that I have this belief that things are going to work out generally. And I think that, you know, in many ways, things that I've viewed in the past, I've gotten fired a bunch growing up, things that I viewed as obstacles and challenges at that time, things I was depressed about or sad about, ended up being unbelievably useful gifts and contributing to a life that I'm now very happy with. And so I think that, that perspective of just sort of surrendering and or trying to, you know, this is an ideal, I don't do this all the time, but trying to just surrender and be like, you know, this is what life is giving me, and it's right, whatever it is, it's right, is something that I really try and like live by and embody.
That's wisdom.
It's not my wisdom. It's just shit I've read, but yeah.
And apply.
Yeah, and it works for me. I mean, I'd say that I'm pretty happy most of the time.
Yeah. And if you can be happy most of the time and you can be fulfilled most of the time, like you're living a good life.
Totally.
And
comes with trade-offs too.
Yeah. And so I'm curious, what are the trade-offs from being so calm?
I think that they're, you know, people admire being calm when other people are stressed or depressed or down in the pumps, mm-hmm. or down in the dumps. Mm-hmm. No one is like envious of a calm guy at a concert or something, you know, where like people are like having the best time ever and I'm just like having a pretty good time. Yeah. So I think that that's one. I sometimes feel like I like don't ascend the crazy heights of, you know, some people from an emotional standpoint. I think that I also am less paranoid, which can have downsides, you know, from a business standpoint. I've worked, many of my like good relationships are with business partners that are super in the weeds and super paranoid and always like thinking about like X, Y, and Z, you know, what if I run this thing forward 100 times? And that doesn't always work. It can often cause a lot of like organizational stress and chaos, but certainly they hit and find things that I will miss because I'm just like a little more calm, a little less stressed, a little less like frantic on certain things. And so having that self-knowledge and partnering with people that have that skill and trait has been really useful.
Yeah, I can imagine. I talked to somebody who works for Kettle and Fire or has worked for Kettle and Fire in the past, and they said, you are by far the best boss they've ever had. Mm. And that implies to me that you are, at least to this person, a great leader. So what do you believe makes for a great leader?
That's really nice to hear. I think that it's a couple things. I think as a leader, your job is to set the vision, explain to people why that vision is compelling and why it matters. Almost everyone wants to feel like the work that they do and they put their life energy into actually matters and makes a difference in the world in a positive direction. And I think that it's your job to provide that. And yeah, and that's a big one. The third thing I would say is I'm like very okay with empowering people, and have almost never been called a micromanager. And so
he said exactly that. You're the opposite of a micromanager.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that if you are someone that is growth minded, wants to work hard, wants to make decisions and like fully own and have responsibility and accountability for the things you decide, I will be a useful sounding board. I'm there for you. I'm like there to support, but I will never micromanage somebody pretty much. And so I think that makes for a good experience as someone that's like growth minded and growth oriented.
Mm. How does this apply to parenting?
I have no idea.
I know you don't have children. And
yeah, soon.
Wow. Just
in the next year or two. Yeah. I got married earlier this year, so it's on the mind.
Congratulations on that.
Thanks.
I know, like, from talking to David, that one of your plans is to have a neighborhood of children, of friends, where you can all come together. And I think that's a really cool idea. So, like, what inspired that? And how do you think about going about something like that?
Yeah, I think that it's everyone's dream to live close to their friends. Like, why is it that everyone has such positive associations with college? I think it is because it is the time where you are surrounded by friends more than almost any other in your life. Mm. And by the way, that was normal until about 100 years ago. This is not like, whoa, what a crazy concept. You know, it's just like, no, about 1,500 years ago, you just live near family and friends as a default.
Yeah.
And so I think two things. One, living near friends is awesome. It means more hangouts, you know, more conversations, more dinners, more like social and community, which is really valuable. And honestly, the average person just lacks today in the US, which is sad. And secondly, I think that it's amazing for raising kids. Like, something that I really want to experiment with is everyone that you talk to as a parent today is like, man, it's so hard. And I think it is. But I also think and wonder, if you were surrounded by friends and potentially family, is it possible to do parenting in a way that's not miserable? Like, you read about, you know, families that were having 8 to 15 kids like 80 years ago.
Yeah. You have seven siblings, right?
Yeah. I'm one of seven. Yeah.
Wow.
And so you read about this, and you know, it was hard growing up at times, but it also wasn't like impossible. I mean, you'd have to ask my mom, but, but she said she loved it. You know, having a big family was like really meaningful, and it was an amazing experience for her, for us, for everything. And I think that so many people today are like, oh, I can't have more kids because it's so hard. And I just really wonder if the thing that makes kids so impossibly hard today is either economic, i.e., you know, both parents have to be working to afford to live in X place to send their kids to a school or whatever, or is it that we have basically outsourced the social fabric of our society to a bunch of, you know, real estate broker? Have we just like lost the social connection that made parenting, or, you know, being a parent, raising a family that much easier 60 years ago?
Yeah. I think a lot of the problems we have today are outsourcing the problem to technology of some sort, but it's like, how do you live with the technology and get the best out of the technology while also maintaining what we used to have 50,000 years ago, right?
Yeah. I don't know if you can, honestly.
Yeah.
I actually want to, like, my family lives in Pennsylvania now, and next time we go back, my wife and I want to, like, go interview some of the Amish people that, like, live in the communities that live near us, just because I'm so curious about, do they think parenting is hard? Do they think raising a family is hard? Like, I don't know. They seem to have about as rich of a community life as you could have in the U.S. today, and I'm just curious, like, how they think about this stuff.
I feel like there's also a need or a feeling of wanting to know that sort of information online. Like, I've seen certain pieces of content where I'm like, long form discussions with Amish people, like, is something that I could imagine being very successful in today's day and age.
Totally.
So if you ever think about publishing those, I would love to watch them, even if you don't.
Cool. Yeah.
Can we talk about before you parent someone, getting into a relationship, how do you find a partner?
I got lucky. I mean, my wife and I met on the street. In New York, outside of a nightclub. So,
wow.
Yeah. I thought and still think she was cute. Walked up to her, said hi. And then that kind of started, you know, our relationship. I think that dating is hard for a lot of reasons. And I think that it is not easier today due to, like, the rise of dating apps and all these sorts of things. Like, one of the things that I think a lot about is, I don't know how this is going to come off or not, but basically, have you ever looked at OkCupid's dating? Like, they write amazing blog posts on basically how men and women date differently. They have different dating strategies.
Yeah, I think I've seen that one.
Yeah. So basically what you see is men follow a strategy of, they basically will like anyone who is roughly the same attractiveness level as them and up. So if you are a man in the 60th percentile attraction range, you will like every woman who is 60% and up. Women follow what is called like a hypergamous dating strategy, which is basically, and again, this is like statistically speaking, doesn't mean that any one woman does anything, but it effectively means that almost no matter where you are on the spectrum from an attraction standpoint, which is what online dating filters for, or, you know, how people make their decisions for the most part, women will choose the top 5 to 15% of men on the attractive spectrum. And so what this means in my mind is you basically have a bunch of men in the US that their experience of online dating is they get maybe one or two matches every now and then, and it's like not a good tool. And then you have this other set of men who are in the top whatever percentage for X trait that people find attractive, who have a flood and unlimited options. And I think that this dynamic creates really, really bad situations where, you know, a bunch of women are chasing a certain type of person. A bunch of men feel like kind of left out of the dating pool, and it's not a good or stable situation. So I basically think that the best thing that you can do is probably opt out, probably find, like, Don't do it for the most part.
Opt out of the online dating.
Yeah, opt out of the online dating stuff. I think finding rich, deep communities where people are really doing shit that you care about and find interesting, whether that's going to sauna, cold plunge, working out, doing whatever. Like, these are the things that I would do if I was newly single today. You know, but find something that you're passionate about and where you are interested enough in it that your interest makes you high status in that thing, or potentially puts you on a path towards being high status. Like, if you're into working out, if you're in amazing shape, you're a high status at that gym, and like, that's the mating market that you want to fish in. And so I would just think about doing that, like go to church, do any number of these things.
Yeah. Like, I've never really thought about it in those lines, but you want to, where your strengths naturally shine, like, try to make them even greater, because the person who's funny and is a comedian and is the funniest comedian is going to dominate that mating pool.
Totally.
And that's an interesting, like, way to think about it.
Yeah, I think humans are just status seeking animals, and if you meet someone doing a thing you care about, and, you know, he or she is also doing a thing that they care about, and you're trying to be like a high status, friendly, approachable person in that environment, I think it's an amazing way to meet somebody.
Justin, I could talk to you forever, and I have about 2 or 3 more hours of conversations we have for us, not limited to curing eyebrow dander, nootropic ebooks, beta testing Kettle and Fire with PayPal and Google Ads, almost launching White Claw. Yeah, we have a lot of good stuff to talk about. Hopefully for a part two, hopefully that gets people excited enough to send you messages to come back on the podcast. But before we do, I like to end these episodes with challenges. A challenge points to the place in your heart you believe people should take this conversation and actually do something with it to live a better life. Does a challenge come to mind?
I think that most people would be shocked by how, if they challenge themselves to do a Whole 30 or eat super clean or something for 30 days, I think most people would be shocked by the number of the amount of self-esteem that they would get from that, the amount of competence and feeling better they would get from that, and the amount of like mental and physical positive changes that they would go through. And I often recommend, so many people will say, you know, paleo diet is stupid, this is stupid, whatever. Try it for 30 days and just see how you feel. And I think that in an environment and a society where truly the average person is just getting poisoned by our food system all the time, opting out of that for 30 days and just seeing how you feel is one of the most empowering and challenging things that someone can do today.
I love that challenge so much. Thank you so much for spreading the wisdom, the knowledge, the information. Where should we send people to connect with you further?
Check out my, I have a Substack called The Next. It's justinmayers.substack.com. I'm also on Twitter at JWMayers. And those are probably the best places.
Highly recommend The Next. Used it for great preparation on this podcast. And it's a really great resource. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you.